Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
On this week's episode of White Wine Question Time.
60 million downloads later, you are the Anton Deck of audio. What the hell's happened?
Well, me and Rory Stewart rather than me and Grace.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. I honestly don't know, really, because I find it a bit weird. Hands up, I've always been very combative in politics. If I see a Tory opponent there, I'm going to go for them. Yesterday, when Sunak put out his ridiculous message to the
lionesses.
Oh my God, you know, you left nothing out there. So I had a go.
Did you have to go out and have a bike ride to get rid of the anger and frustration, Alistair?
When we won the election in 1997, I'll never ever get over the fact I didn't enjoy it.
How could you not?
He was like, this is stressful, there's too much going on, there's too much noise, what the fuck do you want? I've got to get out of my way.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week has swapped out first the corridors of Fleet Street for the corridors of power at the heart of Tony Blair's government, and is now trailblazing the corridors of podcasting alongside co-host Rory Stewart on the UK's number one podcast, The Rest is Politics. The show's success is, well, frankly, astounding. In the 18 months since its launch back in March 2022, it's been downloaded more than 60 million times, and half of its audience are under 34. Their live shows have sold out at the Royal Albert Hall, and their upcoming show at the London Palladium sold out in under 7 minutes, faster than the Foo Fighters. As plot twists and life tangents go, it's pretty epic, and in many ways ironic. I mean, having spent years in politics trying to reach young or apathetic voters, he's fast become their new political hero at the grand age of 66, with millions hanging on his and Rory's every word as they break down and disagree agreeably about the political events of the day. Born in West Yorkshire, he describes his childhood as very James Herriot. Bright and sporty, he enrolled at Cambridge University in 1975 and studied in France for a year, where he had his first pieces published, writing pornography for Forum magazine under the pseudonym Riviera Gigolo. True story. His career in journalism started in earnest when he joined the Mirror Group newspapers as a trainee, where he met his partner, Fiona Miller, who he shares three grown-up children with. His rise from local newspapers to flagship title The Daily Mirror was fast and furious, and he was appointed eventually political editor. Then in 1994, a call from Tony Blair came and it changed his game. He was asked to reshape Labour's story to help propel them to power and became Director of Comms following a landslide election victory. For almost half a decade, he remained at the heart of government. But the 2003 invasion of Iraq brought about his resignation as Downing Street spokesman amid accusations that he'd sexed up MI5's dossier on the threat Iraq posed to justify the invasion. Since then, he's continued in his role as an advisor, be it to Gordon Brown or Ed Miliband, as well as French President Emmanuel Macron and the Albanian Prime Minister. He's also written extensively, 18 books no less, covering his years in politics via his extensive diaries and now his latest brainchild, But What Can I Do?, a book that deep dives our broken political system and offers up some solutions. Now, this is his second time on the show. The first time he came on, he was with his daughter Grace. And back then, the rest is politics was but a twinkle in his eye, so there is a lot to catch up on. And he's even made time to do this while he's on holiday in France. Let's dial him in, shall we? It's Alistair Campbell. How are you, sir? Bonjour, ça va?
Bonjour, ça va très bien, et toi?
Bien. Having a lovely time over there, cooking in France.
Yeah, it's pretty hot. I've just been out on the bike. It's interesting, when I go on the bike, when it's really hot, I went out the other day, and Fiona, my partner, she's got this thing where she started calculating the heat in Fahrenheit, not centigrade, going back to the old days, and yesterday it was 101. Mm. And I went out on the bike, which was probably a bit crazy.
Yeah.
And I was out on the bike where it was 93. Yeah. So, hot.
I foresee a time when we operate by night and sleep by day just to beat the heat.
Well, assuming we're all still here and the world's still here. I mean, I used to think that whole thing about the Spanish eating really, really late was just kind of weird. But, you know, you get it now, don't you? Have a big nap.
Yeah, and the heat literally knocks you off your feet and you have to have the siesta. Or maybe you're just old.
Well, I'm 66. How old are you?
50.
So you're not old.
You're just older.
I don't feel I'm old.
I did start my career literally bringing you tea, Alistair. So there is, you know, there is some kind of gap there.
Yeah, yeah.
I still remember with great fondness, by the way.
Nice tea.
Well, you know, seeing as I don't drink it and you didn't spit it in my face, I think I did quite well. You were far more receptive than Anne Robinson ever was.
Annie has a certain way.
Yes, that's polite. I think you're even more polite than Rachel Riley on that one. Now, listen, since we last spoke, you came on with Grace, you had your own podcast, you were enjoying the podcast space, and then I turn around, 60 million downloads later, you are the Anton Deck of audio. What the hell's happened?
Well, me and Rory Stewart rather than me and Grace.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. I honestly don't know, really, because I find it a bit weird. Yesterday, because I listened to a lot of German stuff, and yesterday I've got these political podcasts I listen to in Germany, and I was out on the bike yesterday, and I thought, I've got to start listening to some new podcasts. So I just Googled highest rating German podcasts, right? Now, the ones in the UK are all about how to learn German, so then I had to sort of change the thing, so I got the German ones coming through. And you got down to the, like, 30s and 40s and 50s before you got anything vaguely political.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. There was all lifestyle and travel and food and sport and that sort of stuff. Whereas us, you know, we've been consistently number one. The rest is politics. And now the rest is politics leading, like, for over a year.
Yeah. You've never left the top five.
No. It's really, really strange.
The irony is that you've spent most of your political life trying to reach apathetic or young or disenchanted potential voters, and yet here you are now at 66, almost Christ-like in their eyes, Alistair, with an incredibly young listenership. Half your audience is under 34. That is, you know, political
gold. Is that
right?
Gold. Do you know that?
Yeah.
Do you know that?
I don't know that. It's what I've read, and I've tried to fact check it as best that I can. So, for transparency, only Goalhanger would know that.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what was interesting is when we did the Albert Hall last year. I remember again, Fiona and my daughter Grace. They were sort of coming down out of the tube, and I was already there. And they came in to see me in the dressing room and said, it's weird out there. It was like, you know, it was like going to a sort of pop concert, you know, it was like all these young people. And that definitely, I think we measured it, over a third were under 30.
It's not just so, that, though. You think about that night, right? So for a start, your tickets sold faster than the Foo Fighters. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. Secondly, all of those people came to see that show at the Royal Albert Hall when the show was little over a year old. They came in heavy snowfall on a train strike day, and you still filled the room. To watch two middle-aged white men discuss politics.
Mm. I know. That's what I mean, is I don't really understand it. Look, I could sort of, you know, I can, I don't mind. I'm not brilliant with praise, to be honest. But if I try and analyse it, and I sort of analyse what people say to us, is it's two people that they think have kind of, you know, been there, done it in different ways, still care about it, worry about it a lot, and try to give people accessible, understandable, grown-up discussion about it. That's what we try and do.
I know that that was kind of the raison d'etre from the get-go. And I don't think you can underestimate how important that is by way of the ingredient of success for the rest is politics. The fact that you can both disagree and clash agreeably.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, like, and it's been quite a journey for me. I hate that word, but you know what I mean? It's been a bit of self-revelation, because I am a very combative person, and I'm, you know, style in debate has always been, you know,
bombastic. Just,
and I've really sort of thought it through about whether it is the right way. And I did, because the other thing that's happened alongside it was that, and it was totally coincidental, because I'd already started, had this idea about writing a book about trying to generate more interest in politics and people get more engaged, and particularly young people. And it's sort of, they've come at the same time. And so there's, and that book went straight to number one. I actually had a period
But what can I do?
So it was number one in the charts while we were number one in the podcast charts, while we were filling the Albert Hall. It was utterly mad. And I just, I can't quite work it out. And then, anyway, eventually, talking to the German podcast, I eventually found one, and it's called Gysi Gegen Gutenberg, and it's basically modelled on ours. It's a left-wing guy. And then so I listened to the first couple, and then about their fifth one, they say, we've decided to do a Q&A.
They really have ripped you off. Or reheated your format.
Well, I don't know whether it's coincidence, but it's interesting that when I got down, that they were about sort of low 30s in the charts, right? But they were the number one political podcast.
You've really struck a chord. And I love that you can see now the learnings in sort of being less bombastic and more learned about listening, because I think it's something we all need to do in a digital society where it's so polarized. You guys have actually found an intelligent grey area that's neither black nor white, it's a little bit of both, and it's up for discussion. We have to learn from that, don't we?
I think so, and I think the politicians need to as well, and the media do as well, because, you know, why has this podcast kind of, you know, hit this mark that it has? Now, partly it's part of there's a whole thing about podcasting developing, people who weren't listening to podcasts even 2-3 years ago who now are. Yeah. But again, I think the mainstream media hasn't really caught on to that. I think there's something about that feeling that politics has to be combative. And look, I've always been very combative in politics. If I see a Tory opponent there, I'm going to go for them. Yesterday, when Sunak put out his ridiculous message to the
lionesses,
oh my god, you know, you left nothing out there. So I had a go.
Did you have to go out and have a bike ride to get rid of the anger and frustration, Alistair?
Not the anger and frustration, but I just thought, so I still will have a pop, but at the same time, I recognize that I had this. I think the other thing that happened, it wasn't just talking to Roy Stewart, and we had quite a clash last week. We've had one or two, you know, real
Northern
set
Ireland.
Twos.
You've had a big Northern Ireland.
But when I was doing, I was asked to do Question Time, BBC Question Time, rather than the rest is Politics Question Time, a few weeks ago. I don't know if you saw it. It was the one where the whole audience were had voted Leave, and it was in Clacton.
No, I didn't. So
I had a discussion on the podcast about whether people thought I should do it, talking to Rory about how to handle it, blah, 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 blah. So I'd already decided I'm not going to be too combative. Anyway, on the way there, sort of a couple of days before it happened, I got an email out of the blue from a school teacher called Abby. And she said, I see from the media you're going to Clacton, you're doing this Brexit thing. I teach at a school in Clacton in one of the toughest parts of the country, one of the poorest parts of the country. We actually, our catchment area includes JRIC, which is really, really sort of, you know, got reputation quite poor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Why don't you come and have a look in on the way? So I thought, okay, interesting, yeah, get through. The book was out and, you know, I'll go and talk about that and try and get them engaged. Anyway, I went there and I actually did a school in the morning in London, quite a kind of, it was a state school, but it was in quite a kind of, you know, it was a pretty good area and it was a very good school and what have you, and the kids were really engaged, etc. I would say the only difference when I got to the one in Clacton was that at the start, there was a kind of lack of confidence about coming forward. But as we got into it, they were really, really good. And I ended up, and I used this on the programme, I said, listen, I've got to know you a bit. Let's have a few votes. If there was a vote to go into the European Union tomorrow, who's going in and who's staying out? All but two are going in, right? And I was able to use that on the thing about, you know, okay, I respect you for what you did. You vote, you thought you're doing the right thing, but just understand your kids all think you're wrong. Right.
And they're the ones that are going to have to deal with the consequences.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But there was a girl there called Annabelle. And when I was, I'd been there for about an hour or so talking to them. And I said, right, okay, I'm going from here to do Question Time. And it's, they're all going to be 100% audience voted Leave. How shall I handle them? And they also, you know, thought of it. And then I said, do you think I should trim my views? And this girl, Annabelle, said, don't trim your views. People won't respect you for that.
No.
Stick to your views, but try to understand why their views are different. And then she said this, which I've used now, and I use it in the podcast as well. She said, try and persuade without criticising. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I've talked about that a lot because I just thought it sort of said something about what you hear most of the time on the media. And I've got to be honest, I barely watch the news anymore. Partly because it's so depressing, partly, but it's formulaic. You know, here's a fact. Here's what somebody says about a fact. Here's what somebody else says about a fact. There's a different view. And here's a BBC or a Sky person coming on to sort of try and make sense of it all, right? And then the sort of, you know, and I'll be honest, the reason I listen to German stuff a lot, other than the fact that I'm trying to sort of keep my German good, it's just more serious. They're more serious about stuff. And I just don't think we're very serious anymore. I don't think we're a serious country.
I think that 60 million downloads, predominantly from men and women under 35, listening to two intelligent men who sit on very different sides of
that's
the political pond.
That's an improvement from middle-aged, by the way, intelligent.
But you know, beyond middle-aged, actually. There you go. I think that proves that we are a serious country. That you have found the curious, and you've written this book that not only lays out where it all went wrong, which anyone can do, but you've also started to come up with, and here's what you can do. Here's some solutions. And you don't pretend to have all the answers, which must go against the grain, because that's exactly what you expected to have in office. But you're open to being the conductor of the orchestra that has the discussion. That seems to be where you are. And what a fascinatingly exciting place to find yourself, Alistair.
Oh, that's a very nice way to put it. It is. I mean, it's frustrating. It's very, very frustrating. I do find it very frustrating. I think that I've always felt that it's important that if you think you can make a difference, you've got to try to make a difference. I still get lots and lots of people telling me that I'm selling myself short and I should do more and I should get back into politics and blah, blah, blah.
Well, Rory Stewart thinks that you could become Prime Minister if you wanted to. He says that when Alistair wants something, He absolutely makes it happen. He's somebody who makes the world move around him. He could be Prime Minister if he wanted to very easily. He just needs to put his mind to it.
No, I think he was speaking in the best sense. I think he think,
I don't think he was. Don't get out of it that way.
Could have been. I mean, look, you know, we talked about the Zimbabwe election. The candidate for the presidency is 80. Trump and Biden. But I think you'd be a young man, Alistair.
You'd be a young man.
I know. I think I've got enough self-awareness to know it's not going to happen. And therefore, quite like you are sort of conducting the orchestra thing, but therefore you try and make a difference in different ways. And yeah. I say in the book that, I mean, I've got this sort of fantasy that on the day I die,
yes.
That there's going to be, that whoever is Prime Minister the day I die, somebody whose name we don't yet know, is going to have this thumbed copy of "But What Could I Do?" and say, the book that made me want to be Prime Minister. And then that will be...
It was his manual to number 10, yeah.
I think what I've had some amazing letters and stuff there. I got one yesterday. So I went with... I did an event recently at the House of Lords with Charles Walker, the Tory MP, both talking about mental health. And I was with somebody who was doing some work experience, and we walked into the House of Lords entrance, and there was this guy there who, very, very tall, taller than me, and he had I'm not saying this because it's important, it's just this is how I remember him. Very, very tall, and he had a prosthetic hand and wrist.
Right.
So we started talking, and he had this bag, and he said, "Oh, that's amazing bumping into you. Love your podcast. And I've just bought your book in the shop down the road." "Oh, thank you very much," I said. Had a chat about this, that, and the other. And he emailed me yesterday. What was his name? James, I think it was. He emailed me yesterday saying, "I read your book on the way home, and I finished it now that I'm back in Canada. Do you know what? I was actually thinking of giving it all up. I was thinking that politics is no longer for me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But on the back of reading this book, I've decided I'm going to stick it out. I'm going to try and help politics, blah, blah." So, you know, and most of the people who maybe are being affected like that can be affected. Some of them do tell you, right? I get lots of letters and emails of people saying stuff like that. But that also means there's lots of people that maybe it's affecting positively you don't know about.
Yeah.
Including that one. Going to be there on the day I die.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that if enough people... Because when I said earlier, not a serious country, you rightly corrected me on that. There are a lot of serious people in Britain. But I think the combination of not having a serious politics at the moment...
You cannot be governed by a circus and there are times when in recent times, I mean, we've had more prime ministers in the last 2 years than we have in the last 10. You know, I mean, that in itself is something of a circus, isn't it?
Yeah. And also, but I also think with Sunak, I mean, you know, he's got this sort of, he trades on being more serious than Truss and Johnson. But honestly, I don't think he's governing, you know, this whole... It's sort of performative. The whole thing is just performative the whole time.
But did you not feel that he was like the supply teacher that ended up being given the headship because there was no election?
No.
There's no election. He's not the people's choice. He's the party's choice.
Well, he's not even that because they were worried that if he went back to the party, they'd get, you know, somebody trust Mark too. Which they would. You know, I'll tell you, if there was a leadership election of the Tory membership tomorrow, Suella Braverman's the Prime Minister. I'm telling you. I mean, utterly ridiculous, utterly absurd. But we said Truss was absurd. We said Johnson was absurd. So that's my point. And then what we have is like we have a media that, even though it's gone from ridiculous, useless leader to the next, just covers them in exactly the same way. You know, every day, Sunak to promise this. They never go back and look at the promises that were made.
But the bit you don't see, right, because you and I have been raised through traditional journalism and traditional media, and you still look to the front pages. I don't think people are. More people listen to your podcast than read those newspapers. You are arguably more persuasive and more powerful than those titles.
Hmm.
60 million downloads.
Yeah, but a lot of people, the same people doing it every day, every week. And also, look,
but
I'm
you
not...
know full well in politics, the repetition of a message is so important. Oh, yeah. And repetition of information is so important.
No, I agree with that. But my point is that why I still think, look, there's no doubt podcasts are changing the media landscape. No doubt about that.
I think news, I think this is where good journalism can thrive in a way that it can't in print anymore because the budget's just not there.
Yeah, and also because the advertising model of Google and Meta and those guys is just kind of is killing the newspapers and local newspapers in particular. But my point is that I still think that for a lot of the people, look, I know from the letters we get that a lot of the people who listen to us aren't listening to anything else political. Okay, so that does give you a kind of special role in their political development, if you like. But at the same time, within the broader political landscape, I still think television is very, very powerful. Mm. And my complaint with television has always been it treats our newspapers like they're some sort of independent arbiter of what's happening in the country and happening in the world, whereas actually the bulk of our newspapers now are just propaganda rags. That's what they are.
Because of the political bias of their proprietors.
Yeah, totally. Who are a bunch of, you know, very right wing, usually not paying tax, often not British, with who use their commercial interest as part of their commercial arm and their political arm together. Now, that's happened down through time. But my point
is not new.
This is not new at all. My point is that I thought the whole kind of internet revolution and now podcasting and artificial intelligence and all that stuff, I thought it would break that apart. Whereas in fact, in a bizarre sort of way, it's consolidated it. You've got the old oligarchs who still have a lot of influence within debate. Then you've got the new oligarchs, like, you know, who are so ridiculous. I mean, Musk and Zuckerberg talking about having a fight. I mean, at least Carnegie and these guys used to sort of build universities.
How embarrassing was that? Would you say that you agree with some of the stuff that Prince Harry has said about the link between a broken media and a broken government, and the fact that we had that moment, didn't we, with the internet, which is the Wild West in so many ways because it's so unpoliced. Nobody got in there and structured it safely. Mm. And now it's kind of like, you know, the algorithms rule us, don't they? You can't be fed something that is outside of a view you've already shown an interest in. Your algorithms are narrow tunnels.
I know. And that's why it's important to try to keep your mind open. And it's hard. It's hard.
But in a digital world, you have to actively go and look for stuff that you don't agree with to make sure that the algorithms are a little bit healthier in terms of what's fed back to you, I think.
Or you've got to try to limit what's fed. You either expand what's fed to you or you limit it. And you limit its ability to influence you. We did. We talked on the podcast recently to the Israeli guy, Yuval Noah Harari. Mm. And I reminded him of something he'd said in one of his books that he wrote some years ago now. And he said, what is going to happen to us if we get to a stage where algorithms know us better than we know ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
Now, he said that when he wrote that in 2016, he thought he was talking about something decades away. Yes. It's happening now.
Barack Obama said that he felt that in a digital age, there is absolutely no fighting chance of a fair election.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. Now, there's always been unfairness in political systems and in elections and what have you, but it's now got to a completely different level. I don't think that without, who knows, you can't prove sort of counterfactuals, but I don't think Brexit would have happened without the combination of our existing mainstream media structures, right-wing oligarchs influencing the broadcasters, and these new kids on the block, Cambridge Analytica and all that stuff. I don't think Trump would have become president without his ability to capture a certain demographic via the relentless messaging through social media, and he's also using mainstream.
And I think that's what Barack Obama was saying, is that, you know, the potency of an echo chamber created on an algorithm, you can't underestimate that, because all you're doing is compounding somebody's belief in something and not ever allowing them room to change their mind.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If. Only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Listen, I could talk to you about this stuff forever and a day, but I do have questions for you, Alistair. So can I dive in on my very first one?
Okay.
I wanted to talk about unlikely friendships and partnerships that life has sent your way. Because, you know, obviously we're talking to you in the midst of an incredibly successful period in your life. Where you sit alongside Rory Stewart, a man you were thrown together with off the back of an internet poll that you staged on your Instagram feed. And I wanted to know what value and what differences the oil and water friendships and partnerships in life have brought to your table, and which are the most standout in terms of the oil and water relationships that you've kind of grown to love?
Oh, Lord. I mean, it's hard if I... Right, so I'll tell you the first name that popped into my head when you're asking the question was Alan Clarke.
Right.
Tory MP, Tory minister, major philanderer, great diarist, unbelievable gossip, and very, very right wing with some views that I would consider to be utterly beyond the pale. Now, what, looking back, so he died a few years ago, and he died in one of those extraordinary situations. I remember David Davis, who's another Tory that I've been very friendly with at times. I've gone off him since Brexit, I've got to say, but anyway. don't let that get in the way. It was another one. It was Nicholas Soames. But when Alan Clarke died, he just sort of died. And I remember Nick Soames saying he couldn't bear for people to see him in the way that he was when he was really, really ill. So he just turned to the wall and died. I thought that was a brilliant observation because I can't quite work out whether actually the relationship that I had with Alan Clarke, would I define that as a friendship? Because I was a journalist when I first got to know him, and I was on a Labour-supporting newspaper, and he was a minister in a Tory government, and he was one of the few Tory ministers that would absolutely lay his hair down with me. So it became, almost like a transactional relationship. But then, when we won the election and I got into working in Downing Street, in a way, I think I fed his desire to know what was going on. And, you know, he'd phone me up and he just wanted to gossip. I would say that became a friendship of sorts. But I think in politics, it's been really interesting. For example, how if I look at all the people I used to spend my time with in government and working in the Labour Party, some of the people that I maybe didn't expect to keep in touch with, I have.
Right.
Some of the people I thought I would have kept in touch with much more, I haven't. Mm. And maybe that's because the relationship that you you identified yourself as a friendship because you're speaking a lot, working together a lot, agree a lot, helping each other a lot. But actually, it's almost like, again, it's a different form of transactional relationship. Mm. Need each other.
Doesn't mean it's not important, though. And it doesn't mean that it's not important at that time, does it? And that these relationships bring something to your table, you know?
Absolutely. And also, you know, I think one of the reasons I'm obsessed with sport and why I think politicians don't take sport nearly seriously enough, not just in terms of its value to the country, but also in terms of what they can learn from it, is that whole thing about how you put teams with people who are thrown together. I was, you know, my team, Burnley, I was watching, you know, the team that we've got this year, the main sort of starting 11, it's like transformed from what was there 2 years ago. Literally, it's a new team.
Yeah.
Now, in the ground, you've got pretty much the same people. And they're transferring their affections to all of these people who are just getting to know each other. And then I've got friendships. Well, I've got good relationships with lots of players down the years. And I was talking to one of them at the weekend who left us a year ago. And he was saying, God, look at that team now. It's completely different. I don't know half of them. So will he stay friends with those people who he'd lived with day in and day out?
And it's the intensity of a teammate, which is exactly what you experienced in government as well.
Yeah.
And you're going through really, really intense experiences together, making very difficult decisions. And if you care and you take that responsibility seriously, then that is very consuming. And I think that the one thing that so many listeners have taken away from listening to you and Rory is that you both really care. You still really care. And I don't know that our politics has enough people in it that are driven by that agenda of caring rather than caring for themselves.
Yeah, I think a lot of people in politics really do care. But I think I do worry that some of the ones who've been very high profile in recent years have... they've given such a bad reputation for... I mean, honestly, I try not to go on about it too much, but Johnson did so much damage to our politics and still does. The fact that Suella Braverman is still in there as a powerful figure is partly down to Johnson. The fact that Nadine Dorries has become a national figure for not doing her job and getting away with it. And if Boris Johnson had never been Prime Minister, she'd have never got near a cabinet position. Not even close. And so he's done, and the lying, you know, I think that, look, people have always said, oh, politicians are all the same, they're all lying. People have said those things, but they're nonsense. Most politicians are not liars, most politicians are not all the same. But Johnson gave people good reason to believe that, because if you're such a liar and you get to the top, and you have the whole party machinery defending you, supporting you, no wonder people go, oh, they're all the same, you know? So, and I think that's why it's, you
would
know...
You like, would you like to invite him on to The Rest Is Politics to discuss all of this and more?
Yes, I would, yeah.
Do you think he'd ever do it? I mean, this is a man that hid from Piers Morgan in a fridge on telly.
I don't think he would do it. I don't think he would do it. But I'd love to talk to him about it in a serious way.
Mm. I'd love to hear it.
Well, and you know, and to cut through the bluster... I've seen the bluster all my life. I've seen the bluster when we were both journalists. I've seen the bluster when I was working in Number 10 and he was a journalist. I've seen the bluster. I'll never forget once when I was walking through, I was still working with Tony Blair. And I think I'd left working with Tony Blair, but I was, for some reason, I was in the House of Commons and I was wandering through. And Boris Johnson was sort of wandering through. He was the mayor at the time. And he did this whole thing of running up to me and going, oh, marvellous, you know, I'm hearing all these rumours you're going to run for London Mayor, which is utter bullshit. Be marvellous thing to do, wonderful thing to do. And it was a sort of weird combination of flattery, deception, and that's what he's always been. And I think some people saw through him early on, But a lot of people didn't. Mm. And a lot of people still haven't. You know, you still hear people saying, oh, I wish we had Boris Johnson. I mean, you know, it's a dwindling band. But, you know, the Rees Moggs of this world and Dean Dorries, the Priti Patels, the...
It's interesting, isn't it, with Rees Mogg? Because his father is somebody that you go back to a lot in But What Can I Do? You actually have a huge amount of respect for Jacob Rees-Mogg's father and a lot of what he had to say. That doesn't extend down to his son, though.
I don't know whether it's respect. I've got a lot of respect for his intelligence. I mean, he wrote this book that I write about in But What Can I Do? The Sovereign Individual, which is one of the cleverest books I've ever read in my life.
This is his father, not Jacob Rees-Mogg, by the way, yeah.
Yeah, because he just predicts so much of what we're living with now. He doesn't call it social media. He doesn't call it, well, he does call it crypto. He doesn't call it artificial intelligence. I was having a discussion.
It's like a prophet. Stewart.
Well, but it's worse than that. He's basically, it's not a prophet who's predicting. He's an activist who's saying, this is the world we have to try to create.
Oh, and he was for it.
We, the rich people... We, the powerful, we need to get more rich and we need to get more powerful. And that means basically we've got to destroy politics, destroy the nation state. And funny enough, I was talking, Rory Stewart and I were talking to a guy for the podcast. He's coming out in a few weeks, next week, I think, about artificial intelligence. Mm. And he was, we didn't talk about William Rees-Mogg, but he was talking about his worry about artificial intelligence is going to break down the nation state. And of course, so yeah, I mean, look, far be it for me. I'm assuming that Jacob Rees-Mogg gets any royalties out of his dad's books now. So far be it for me to say people should read The Sovereign Individual. But if you want to know where the radical right is coming from, it's a truly astonishing book.
Interesting. Can I talk to you about Rory and the other people that were contenders to become the oil to your water? It was a no from Dominic Cummins. It was muted that Nigel Farage should be your foil. Would either of those have been anywhere near as good as what's transpired between you and Rory by way of a partnership?
No, I don't think so. I think the thing about...
Cummins would have been interesting for the first six episodes because just to hear you two together. But then after that... Don't know. And Farage?
I think that's
right.
He's a
bit cartoon.
And I think with Dominic Cummings, it would have been... I don't think we'd ever have got over talking about Brexit.
just like a big broken record.
I see. And look, I think I'm a bit of a broken record anyway, but I think that would have been tricky. Look, I think with Nigel Farage, he tried to get me to do his GB News show with him.
Right.
We had a couple of conversations about it, but I didn't like the feel of that GB News at all from the word go.
Why's that?
Because I just, when you dig into where the money's coming from and all that stuff, I felt it was all that part of that radical right, the American billionaires and all that stuff. But I've always felt about Farage, listen, I think the guy's done phenomenal damage to the country. And is now doing phenomenal damage to the world by sort of playing into the whole climate nonsense that the radical right do. But you can't deny that he's a very effective campaigner, a very effective communicator. And I think he and I might have had more interesting conversations. But I think the thing about, than with Cummings, but I think the thing about Rory and I is that we've both got quite a lot of varied experience and we've got quite a lot of continuing involvement in different spaces and different ways.
Because you care. So,
yeah, partly that, but also because we do interesting, different stuff. And, I still get involved with a few leaders and governments and stuff, and Rory's doing his charity stuff and travels a lot.
Do you still advise Emmanuel Macron and the Albanian Prime Minister?
The Albanian and one or two others, yes. Macron less than I was. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. And also the Albanian guy, Eddie Rama, he religiously listens to every episode. And also he's partly, and sends me a copy, but partly because He now does his own podcast, which is incredibly successful.
Wow, that's smart.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate party political broadcast, isn't it?
Well, put it this way, if it was just a party political broadcast, it wouldn't be successful.
How does it work?
He gets people on and he says to them, you know, one of the things we did back in the second campaign? One of the campaigns, he's now won three elections, okay? And we've done a lot of the stuff that we did as New Labour, and he's a big kind of New Labour sort of aficionado. But one of the things we did, I think it was the second campaign, whereas we organised public meetings with people who wanted to criticise him. And we organised stuff where I remember one big event we did where it was almost like a party convention. But instead of having people beamed in who were saying, I love you, you're amazing, waving a flag, you have people beamed in saying, I think you're a liar. Or people saying, don't believe a word you say, you're all the same, you know, or all very well, you swanning around the world saying, blah, 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 what are you going to do about my bins? You know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And because he would roll with it, it was a very effective part of the campaign.
Interesting. And listens to every episode that you and Rory do. The shorthand between you is delightful. I love the way he handles you and the way you respond accordingly. I think he knows which levers to pull with you quite cleverly. I can't believe that when you took to the Royal Albert Hall stage, you'd literally been in the same room five times before, because everything's done remotely, right? He lives in, is it Jordan still? He lives in?
Well, he's moving back, but we've done very few together. But I don't know what you find. I find so you and I are doing this online now. I find that once you get to know somebody, in a way, I think this works almost better.
I would agree. Yeah. And that's something that came out of lockdown.
Rory and I have this thing, if we're interviewing somebody online, where we just point at each other for who the next question or I want to. But we try not to interrupt each other. Because the one thing I've noticed listening to podcasts is that if there's chatter above people talking over each other, or you can't work out who's speaking, I think it's really useful that Rory and I so clearly come from different backgrounds.
I mean, you do highlight his Eton education a lot. I mean, probably as much as you highlight your views on Brexit. Let's be honest. Yeah. I mean, it's not his fault, okay? It's not his fault.
What did you say when you think he handles me very well? What do you mean by that?
I think that he knows how to widen a conversation with you. I think that you have become far less combative in your exchanges with him. And I think that that's filtered through to everything that, you know, we've talked about earlier. The fact that I think that you get into a really nuanced conversation. And actually, he's somebody that's a really good match for you, Alistair. He knows his stuff. And I think you respect that. And I think there's very few people that are as knowledgeable that could sit at a table with you and have this level of conversation. I think Cummings would have been somebody that could do that. I think Farage less so. I think you would have had him for breakfast.
Yeah, yeah. I think the thing, funny enough, last week, though, we talked about King Charles and whether he was worth his 45% pay rise. And actually, I might raise this. We're doing the podcast this afternoon. I think I might raise it because I got quite a lot of criticism for not coming back at him enough on him saying that, you know, when you compare the cost of Buckingham Palace operation with other presidents around the world, because he's mixing apples and pears, because, you know, he's comparing with Macron and Biden, not with, you know, President Higgins in Ireland. But I might have a little dig about that.
Do you like him? You like Rory?
I do, yeah. I mean, would I go on holiday with him? Don't know. I think he's genuinely interesting. I find his blind spots really quite weird. I mean, I just don't understand how you can't be interested in sport. I just don't understand it.
You've got to stop. He just doesn't give a shit.
I know, but he gives a shit about most things. And you see, I going back to what I said earlier, I think you can learn so much from sport. I think sport is so important. But he, so that's, there's that. I think we have this, yeah, I do like him. I think we have, he's a curious guy, and by which I mean he's got a lot of curiosity about him, and I like curiosity. I'm quite curious as well. I like different experiences. I think this thing came along at a time when I really was sort of thinking, you know, well, I have this existential thing going on all the time. You know, what am I? There's never, Fiona was reminding me this morning, there's never been a period in my life when I hadn't thought that I'm wasting my time. and I'm going through one of those at the moment.
Are you?
Yeah.
Why do you think you're wasting your time?
Because I always think I could be doing something more, and I always think I'm not giving everything that I could be giving, and it makes me very frustrated.
Really, I think you're quite exhaustive in your efforts. I always remember watching you strut around the newsroom floor, and I say strut because you had such urgency to you, Alistair, always, and it was very impressive for a 19-year-old kind of journalism student to see. You were the cock of the walk.
Yeah, but it's sort of, you know, definitely, listen, most of the time when I was a journalist, for the first half of that career, I was just sort of on the road to kind of meltdown through drink and all that stuff. And then for the second part, frankly, until I, you know, jumped onto the political side of the fence, I was constantly torn with this thing. I mean, that was when I had it worse, actually, is that, you know, what am I doing in my life? This doesn't sort of change the world. and so what I enjoyed, the fun part of it, so like I'd say now, with, I was watching that, have you watched At Home with the Furies?
No, but I've heard it's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing, and I'm quite into boxing and all that, and we, you know, so, and but there's one bit where, so there's times, okay, now he's still a fighter, he's still going, but he's, for a fighter, he's now kind of, I guess, my age, you know, he's into his mid-30s, that's old, right? And so there's this bit where he goes with his dad and a few of his kind of entourage. They go to the Isle of Man and they're doing a talk with all the fans. And I had a really kind of strong feeling from it, because I know whenever we've done, when Rory and I have done the Albert Hall, or when we've done big events together, and I feel really bad because I go on and I do it and I do my best and I get into it and it goes well and people enjoy it. And then I come off and it's like, And the team are all like really excited about it. And I'm just like, well, what's next? That was, you know, done that. What's next? And I'm on to the next thing.
So you can never enjoy the moment.
No, not really. Whereas what was amazing about watching Tyson Fury is he came off stage and you could see he was just, it was almost like he won a fight. He was absolutely buzzing with it. And it's that sort of, I don't know what it was, but adulation or whatever. And
adrenaline.
And I just don't get that. I've never, you know, I think I said to you last time we spoke when we won the election in 1997, I'll never ever get over the fact I didn't enjoy it.
How could you not?
It was like, this is stressful, there's too much going on, there's too much noise, what the fuck do you want? I've got a job, bro, get out of my way. And so, and I think that the metaphor, sort of, you know, metaphor in a way for the fact that, I mean, look, Fiona said it this morning. She said, look, you know, maybe you just got to live with the fact you're never, ever, ever going to be happy about what you do.
Yeah. Thank God you met her. I mean, thank God you met her, seriously. She's been your one constant, hasn't she, across your adult life? 21, weren't you, when you met?
Yeah.
Straight out of the traineeship at the Mirror.
No, I think my life would be, I mean, who knows, but I think it would be a bit of a mess, to be absolutely frank.
Any other oil and water relationships that have added to your experiences of life?
I mean, my friends in Scotland get really annoyed, but I've got some good relationships with people in the SNP. I was going to say that, you know, when I was a journalist, I'm trying to think if I had any friends on, genuine friends on rival newspapers. don't know. It's hard on that, isn't it? Because again, it's like, where does the relationship stop being transactional? In other words, I'm going to get with him because I might need him one day when I arrive late on that doorstep, or when I arrive late for it.
And do you think that where you are with Rory is transactional still, or is it seeped into something more meaningful than that?
I think it's hard to tell. No, I'd say definitely something more meaningful, because, you know, the fact you're even asking me means that there's a sense of it. But also I think that, you know, for example, he's had a couple of situations in his professional life or decisions he's had to make, which maybe he wanted to think through. And he phoned me up about them and said, you know, what do you think? How would you handle that? And so and I think that's a sense of, you know, a sort of mutual respect developing and mutual trust as well, because, you know, we do have to tell each other things about, you know, very occasionally I might be doing something that, you know, it's not that it's kind of guilty, I've got guilt about it, but for example, let's just say there was a world leader that I worked with who doesn't want his people to know that I do that, because it would be seen as being a bit weird that he got a foreigner to help him, for example. Or, yeah, let's just say there are other parts of the world where it's more sensitive.
Right.
Right. So I might say to Rory, look, I'm in so-and-so, but don't mention it. You get my drift.
I get your drift. Did you ever foresee a time that you would talk more about your relationship with Rory Stewart than you did with Tony Blair?
Oh, I don't think I do, though. I still think I get more about Tony when I'm out and about. No, but it is definitely, yeah, I think it, and I do find that very weird. I find that very weird. It's like, I mean, I get why people say, well, what people say about Tony, they say, do you still see Tony? People say to me, do you still see Tony Blair? What's he really like? I get that all the time, right?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes, and he's a good bloke. But I do get a lot, particularly like when we go to these events, you know, it's like something a bit kind of, a bit weird about it.
The Anton Deck of audio, just saying.
Please.
And that concludes part one of what will be a two-part conversation with Alistair Campbell, because, well, frankly, when you get unlimited time with the UK's number one podcaster and he's in the mood to talk, you just keep recording. I'll see you back here next Friday to pick up where we left off.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.